Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. All right, so I'm going to say, Dante, you got to help me out. I feel like this interview, I mean, no pressure for either one of us. It's like over a year in the making, right?
Yeah. When did we get connected?
I was trying to think, and I should have gone back to look.
It was like on social media, though.
It was, but it was
on Twitter.
Like summer of last year, maybe?
Might be.
It might have even been. This is crazy, but I will tell you, this book that you are about to drop was worth the wait, my friend.
Well, thank you. I'm excited about that. I'm very excited about
that. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So if you haven't figured it out by now, my guest today is Dante Stewart. He is getting ready to release Shouting in the Fire, an American epistle. And I have notes, but really I have feelings. Like I just don't have a lot of words to put to what I experienced when I was reading this book. So I'm just going to start by saying people who listen to the podcast regularly know I read every book. I think I was telling Dante, I think maybe there's like three books that I haven't read. When I speak with authors and guests for the podcast, I read a lot for school. I read a lot just because I just think it's fun. And I love memoirs. Like they are my jam. This memoir, Dante, it's like in my top three that it's phenomenally well written.
Thank you.
Your story, it's ridiculous.
Thank you. Well, I'm excited. I am very excited to join you. I'm very excited and honored, you know, that you have such wonderful words about my book and about my work and things like that. So that's very, 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 very encouraging. And, you know, I think, you know, we can never kind of diminish just simple words of encouragement, especially in many of the seasons that so many of us are having, and continue to have. So yeah, thank you.
So before we get started, there's so many places that we could
go. Where do we get started?
Where do we? I mean,
what's the entry point?
that's a good question. That's a good question. So I received this book from your team and I read the intro really quickly. Like I had a little break. I read the intro and I thought I'm gonna have to sit down with this one. Like when it happens, I'm gonna have to really sit down with it. So, in the intro, talk about being Black, being American, and being Christian.
Yeah.
All at the same time.
All at the same
right?
time.
Because, yeah. And this is, and I will say you've been Black and American and Christian like your whole life practically, but the book tells your journey of how that has looked differently in different parts and points of your life. Different, your upbringing looked different than your younger adulthood, which looks different than now.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But I feel like this book really highlights what it looks like for you now to be Black and American and Christian. So can you break that down for us?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I felt like, you know, for me, those three identities, you know, and the ways in which they intersect and interlock, in some of the most beautiful and terrible ways possible. We're just, those three identities represented the crux of so many of my questions. They represented the heart of so much of the terrible person I became. You know, those identities represented memories for me, you know, and as people read the book, they will see those memories. They will go back. They will be invited and immersed in the ways in which like those identities took place and were performed in my life. And for me, I just felt like that was what I was wondering, like how in the world do I be Black and Christian and American? Like, how do I wrestle with, you know, what it means to be Black? Like, how do I wrestle with, you know, what does it mean to be Christian, and the ways in which like there's continuity and discontinuity between the Christianity of back home and when I go to Clemson, you know, and then how also do I learn how to be American in a country, you know, that produces people who oftentimes just love to see our bodies in performance or in pain rather than actually embracing us in our full Black self and humanity, but also the larger Black worlds that we come from. And so for me as a writer, I felt like wrestling with those three identities was the type of writing I needed to do if I wanted to write the book that I wanted to write. You know, and Toni Morrison, she has the famous quote that everybody quote all the time, and for good reason. You know, if there's a book, you know, that you want to read that has not been written yet, then write it. You know, and so for me, I felt like I'm not like as a writer, I'm not like, oh man, it's like this new dude on the scene, like he's doing something crazy. Like as far as like, you know, this dude is like, you know, like phenomenal in a way that we've never seen.
You don't think?
Nah, I'm good at what I do, but I ain't like this new phenom, you know, like this new, like I ain't never seen this before. You know, I want people to know that, okay, this has been done before. Or whatnot. I wanted people to know, you know, like this has been done before, but like I haven't seen, if I'm being honest, I haven't seen like books that try to courageously wrestle with that question in a way that the person who's writing is not the hero of the story. And so like for me, I didn't want to write in a way where I was the hero. I just wanted to write an honest book. Like Baldwin said, I want to be an honest man and a good writer, you know? And so that's kind of what I wanted to do. And that's why, you know, I felt like those three identities were important and necessary and critical to the type of book I wanted to produce in the world.
So can I tell the listeners, can I say out loud what I said to you about how I felt about receiving this book?
Yeah, want it. Go ahead. Yeah, it was cool.
It was too expensive. It was too expensive for me to get. I opened it in the intro. I felt that in the intro, I thought, no, this was, your word was costly. That's a better word. This is what you, the way you express, how do I say this? The way that you express your embodied experience was to, it's, I feel unworthy to receive these words in a lot of ways, in a lot of chapters, in a lot of points in different chapters. I feel like, no, this is too expensive. But at the same time, there was a cry, Dante, please don't stop writing. Keep telling us, because it was, I felt that when you said, write it in a way that was honest, that's how I felt. I felt like this was because there are portions where you talk about your upbringing in the Black church, and then portions where you talk about your transition into the white church and school. I'd kind of like to go to the school place, but into the white church, and then where you live now and how you got there, you know, because when you said the performance and pain, right? Yeah. America wants to see Black bodies either performing for them or we American, white Americans sometimes acknowledge when there's Black pain, sometimes. But I would say when you said that, I thought, okay, there was a period when you were in the white church performing for the white church, right?
Oh yeah, 100.
You're preaching, you're pastoring, you're doing all this stuff. Yeah. And then when your pain began to surface and you started, exploring that a bit more, that led to your disconnection with that performance aspect of what you were doing. But yeah. So anyway, so I just thought this was an honest book. It felt very much like I should I even be reading this? Should I even be seeing this? But an American epistle, I think it's important. I think the American church needs to read your story because, as you said, okay, maybe as a writer, this has been done before, but I would also say I am doing my best to listen to a lot of voices, and your story, even though it is very courageously told here, is not unique to you.
Oh no, not at all.
As a Black man in the American church. Right. This is pretty common.
No, this is standard.
It's standard. Yeah.
It's just I'm one of the many people who told it, you know, from my perspective, and tried as best I can to write that type of book.
Can you outline that standard story for us, and then we'll get into the particulars of your story.
Yeah.
Because so there may be some people listening who go, I have no idea what they're talking about right now.
Yeah.
What do you mean standard for a Black man who is a Christian?
Yeah. So I think there's a certain type of reward that those who are not white, you know, get when we go into white spaces. And I want to say white social space. I want to be very crucial about naming white institutional space as white social space. So I'm talking about church. I'm talking about small groups. I'm talking about community groups. I'm talking about Facebook groups. I'm talking about discipleship groups, parachurch organizations, football teams, universities. All this is wrapped up in white social space, which is simply that white people are the standard of this space, are the guiders of this space, and white people are those who determine who is accepted or rejected in these spaces. So white social space is centered around, you know, white people being in a position of power and agency to determine the boundaries and the benefits of being inside this community. And so that's critical to understand for any type of, you know, just simply from a sociological standpoint of naming a space as white social space. So a predominantly white institution like Clemson, where I went, is white social space. White people are guiding the culture, principles, or whatnot, prospects, and even in some sense, the pain of that institution. The white people guide those things. And so, like, when we as Black people go into these spaces, you know, a lot of times for many of us, it's like, you know, our parents tell us, as I outline, you know, in it's like, I think I talk about a little bit quickly, you know, where so many times, you know, when we back home, we get told, like, this is where you make it at. You know, this is where you go to make it. This is where you go to exist. Like, this is where, you know, you got to get as far away as possible from, you know, back home. You know, thinking about back home as a metaphor for many of us, whether that's across race, gender, sexuality, or class realities, you know, back home or this idea of home is a powerful metaphor. Or whatnot, whether you're talking about, you know, somebody fleeing a country, fleeing home, trying to find home again, or whether you're talking about going into another institution trying to find a home, getting as far away from home as possible. Or when you leave those institutions, you graduate, now you got to find home again. You got to recreate it. You got to build it. Or whatnot, learning to adapt and adjust. And so, you know, for many of us who go into these spaces, we're told like, hey, this is how you make it. You got to leave back home behind, you know, and go into this space and make it for everybody. You know, so much is dependent on us making it in this space. But also sometimes some of us are assimilating into those spaces because we want to, you know, so, I mean, a lot of us, you know, so it's just like, you know, this is where we make it. And just because that's where we make it don't mean like we're always actively assimilating to that place or whatnot. It just might just be this is where, you know, this is where access is. And so some of us actually go to those spaces because of that, because of access, you know, and acclaim. Or whatnot. And so there are many reasons why we exist in those in white social space, in particular, white Christian space, or whatnot. But so many times when we get in those spaces, we are both socialized and discipled to center white voices and white people, and also, you know, to allow white people to become the judge and the standard for how we think about ourselves, how we think about God, how we think about the world. So if I'm thinking about sociology again, you know, it's in sociology, you think about, you're also thinking about naming, seeing, and acting within the world. And so when we go into white Christian space, that space becomes all consuming in the ways we name the world, in the ways we see the world, in the ways we act within the world. And so like being an athlete, usually white Christian organizations like Athletes in Action or Fellowship of Christian Athletes are those in closest proximity to us. And so because they're closest proximity to us, you know, we come from back home, like, you know, you got to get involved in church and you got to get involved in some type of spiritual Christian community or religious community. And so, you know, they're in closest proximity to us. And so a lot of us, you know, our rhythms change because our reality has changed, you know, and when our rhythms and reality has changed, especially within white social or Christian space, oftentimes we become things that we don't often realize, but that, you know, other people notice about us. And so like in my book, you know, it's just like when I went back home and, you know, it's just like, you different, you know, you different, you acting different, you talking different, you moving and maneuvering differently and things like that. And so for me, the standard, that why that story is standard, especially in Christian spaces, is because number one, I think also because, you know, when we go to those spaces, like I said earlier, you know, those white Christians have access to us like nobody else. And the gatekeepers in these institutional environments are very particular about keeping white Christians in proximity to us, you know, to keep, whether they call it theological purity, denominational purity, whatever, to uphold these ideas of purity and power, you know, there's a lot of gatekeeping that happens. And so we're in closest proximity to white people. And oftentimes when that happens, you know, our decision-making, our values, our visions and things like that, you know, oftentimes is not guided by where we come from and taking that seriously as a way of knowing the world and naming the world and acting within the world. But then, you know, we believe that, you know, white people are the most important voice. And that to be close to white people is to be closer to God. And that to follow white voices is to follow Jesus. And so the that's a very, very, very standard story that we have to be very mindful of telling in honest, complex, and critical ways. So that hopefully for me, especially as I thought about my book, that I always say this, that hopefully, you know, we can hold out a better story, mm-hmm. you know, because for so many of us human beings, I was just reading today, Renita Weems, a brilliant, brilliant scholar, brilliant, amazing, beautiful person. Dr. Weems, you know, wrote this joint, she gave this lecture on rereading for liberation. And one of the things she says, you know, is about, you know, the story of, I mean, about how human beings are such storytelling creatures, and we resonate with the Bible because before it's ever, you know, a book of rules and instructions, it's a book of stories that helps us generate meaning. And one of the things she would say is that, like, we have to take seriously the stories of Black people in general, but Black women, as she's writing in particular, as a way of thinking about the world. And so when you go into white social space, we don't take seriously our Black stories, our Black lives, our Black worlds as ways to think about the world in legitimate ways of understanding God and our own selves and becoming healed and whole. But oftentimes we devalue those stories. We disconnect from those stories in hopes that white people, you know, in some sense, own like the own, you know, the kind of future of our destiny. And they position, you know, white Christians position themselves that way. They got the money to do it. They got the power to do it. They got the access to do it. They got the marketing to do it. And for me, you know, in this book, you know, I wanted to try and hold out a better story and tell a different story than that story, because I ultimately think that story is anti-Black and needs to be deconstructed and dismantled in hopes that we can hold out something better for us and our pursuit of our full humanity and liberation. So yeah,
I mean, it's definitely a white supremacist story, right? When you're talking about Renita Weems and her womanist perspective, I was thinking, so part of my story I had shared with my husband, I told you earlier that he like woke up in 2020 and I'm like, your wife's brown, you know, like it was, you know, and for what, to be honest, for a while at the beginning of our marriage, we've been married 18 years. And at the beginning of our marriage, he was, really like embraced my Hispanic culture. He kind of wanted me to embrace it more. We had some family, extended family issues that kind of made, just kind of tended toward the white side of my family a bit more. Mm. But I went, not as a dramatic a way, but my story is similar. And this is why I'm saying, like, your story is, it's kind of standard. And I would say the way I would almost describe it, and I had told my husband, this is, it's like, man, being in white spaces, or especially because in Houston, like Houston is such an international city. That, and I joke of myself that I kind of look generically ethnic. And so, you know, depending upon the context I'm in, there's lots of different ways people kind of look at me and assume things about my ethnicity. But I also pass as white pretty easily. And I told him, I said, you know, here's the thing, here's what I learned. And I didn't know I was learning, but here's how I was socialized. Passing as white and being in white spaces is so easy. It's just easy. But what I would say now is it's easy until it's not. Mm. Right. And the picture I had was almost like a current, right? Like it's easy. You get on that lazy river, right, at the water park, and you don't have to do anything. You just grab your raft, you get your drink, you do whatever you want, and it'll just carry you. And then when you realize this is not the direction I actually want to be going, it's more difficult to get off than it was to get on.
Why?
And that's kind of how I feel about this standard story. It's easier to step in. And once you realize, oh, this is going to take me somewhere, cool. I'm good. Everybody's 100. Around me. Great. We got rafts. We got drinks. We're cool. Right. We're relaxing in the sun. And then we go and we go, oh crap. And some people travel there for a year, some people 5 years, some people 10 or 20. And some people continue and they just travel on the river.
Yeah.
And
that's real.
Some people say, I did not realize this is where it was going to take me.
Yeah, that's real. And that's honestly the power of the space, is that, you know, it becomes normative.
Yeah.
You know, it's what Toni Morrison talks about, the white gaze in very profound ways. And she's talking about literature, but I also think that, you know, we can also think about it as a way of seeing the world. Like the white gaze for so many people is normative. It's normative, it's standard. And because it's that way, it's that much harder to uncover and talk about. And so many of those young people who found themselves, whether when you read the book, when people read the book, when I talk about FCA and my time at FCA, many of them probably wouldn't even think of themselves as white. You know, they wouldn't think of themselves as, you know, a part of white social space, you know, and many of them wouldn't even think of themselves as particularly racialized, you know, and to, you know, certain ways of perception and certain ways of acting and congregating and communing with one another, you know. But, you know, oftentimes when that happens or whatnot, oftentimes when we start talking about those things, you know, it becomes hard to talk about, because for them and for even for us, it is the standard. It is the normal. It is the norm. And so it's tough. It's tough to talk about, because number one, it's a hard conversation to have, because to have that conversation is wrapped up with gifts and punishment. So reward and punishment. To have conversations regarding race is always, especially in this kind of space of you, especially when you're talking about the religious space, you know, it's always wrapped up in kind of ideas of salvation, of who's in and who's out. You know, it's like Baldwin said in one of his final essays, To Crush a Serpent, you know, Baldwin talked about, which is, I would encourage everybody to read that essay. It is Baldwin's it's such a searing criticism of the religious right. it is a searing criticism of the religious right, but it's probably one of the most beautifully theological piece of Baldwin text that I've ever read, you know, where he's like saying, like, this is the way they do it, this is what it is, but, you know, here's what salvation is. And oftentimes Baldwin would say that, you know, that oftentimes in these white social spaces, salvation is pretty much caught up in this idea of being white, you know, and being accepted by white people and, you know, being in line with white people. And even though they wouldn't say that and would, you know, deny it altogether, but, you know, at the end of the day, you know, our bodies tell the story, you know, both in history and in this present moment. Our experiences are legitimate ways of us understanding what is going on. And so I think, you know, us telling those stories, that's why I think it's so important for us to tell these stories, because the more we tell the stories, you know, the more we can uncover what's actually going on. And one thing in particular I would say, especially about telling that story, is I'm not telling my story to save white people or save white institutions. And I think that's why actually one of the reasons why I wrote my book the way I did and didn't write it a certain way is I did not want to write a text, you know, that people could easily, you know, and I say this because a lot of times you can't control how people characterize your genre, your work, you know, but I didn't want to make this a book that could be easily characterized as an anti-racist text. You know, I didn't want that for my work. You know, I didn't want, those texts are powerful and it's needed, you know, but I did not want my work to be characterized as that, easily characterized in put in that category, because a lot of times when people talk about anti-racist tech, you know, oftentimes it's like, you know, you want to save the white institution, you want to save the white church, you want to save them. And, you know, I think like Bowen, I personally don't think, you know, I don't think whiteness can be saved. I don't think, you know, that I don't think there's no salvation, you know, in that space or whatnot, especially as we think about history. You know, I'm not thinking about salvation in theological terms. I'm thinking about salvation as it relates to trajectory. You know, there's no salvation of the soil that this institution have grown and flourished in. There's no saving of that. There's no change in that trajectory. And I think, you know, if we tell our stories in hopes to save that, then I think we're telling our stories wrong, because we're centering white people, number one. But I do think we're doing a disservice to ourselves, because we are so much more than what that institution and those people did to us, or the ways in which we responded and reacted to it. But also we're so much more than simply being a way to teach, you know, them and their institutions how to be better humans and Christians and neighbors. We're humans. We're worthy of the deepest love possible. As I say in the last line, you know, the introduction, you know, we're worthy of the deepest love possible. And if we are to be worthy of that love, if that love is to be worthy and worth something, then it will be a type of love that enables us to look at ourselves, embrace our humanity, or whatnot, and tell the story of ourselves in ways that make us feel seen, inspired, loved, and protected.
Would you talk about, I want to move on from there, but before we do, would you talk about how it felt and how you began to recognize when you were fully integrated and living and breathing and working and walking in those white spaces?
Mm-hmm.
How did it feel, and when did you recognize, or how did you recognize that you were the exceptional Black person? This is kind of the way you phrase it, right?
I love that chapter. That was a good chapter. I ain't gonna lie.
That was, they're all like good that, chapters.
When I started talking about the exception, I really enjoyed that, because I felt like it was a chapter that I needed when I was back in those spaces to help me ask those questions a little bit earlier and have better language to understand that experience.
Got it.
And so I wrote it that way because I was really writing to us and those of us who are still there, mm-hmm. you know, who are trying to wade through those questions, but also those who are leaving and dislodging and kind of need a place to stand. And so when I think about how it was, if I'm just being completely honest, you know, it was really like, you know, going to the Southern Baptist Church I was a part of. It was being in home groups and leading home groups, you know, that was consistent. Most of the white people, where every book was written by a white person, that most of the books were focused on like Christian theology and rarely, if ever, focused on like the world that we're living in. The songs and the feelings of worship, you know, was, you know, it's just, you know, foreign, you know, in some sense, you know, it's foreign. But for me, I got immersed in that space, and like, you know, playing football and going to college, you know, you learn when we go off to college, you know, we learn how to adapt and adjust. And I think that's a beautiful, brilliant thing. And I think that's a skill and a gift. It's just that oftentimes, and, you know, as I talk about wages, you know, too often that adapting and adjusting, there's always, you know, a cost.
Yes.
There's always a price to pay, you know? And so, you know, that just, you know, that adapting and that adjusting is great, but oftentimes it's exploited in ways, you know, that, yeah, it's exploited in ways that's just very unhelpful. And so, like, for me, that's like, when I was in that space, that's like listening to nothing but like CCM music, like Bethel and Hillsong and whatever. But also like reading John Piper and reading John MacArthur and reading, you know, all these evangelical men and reading, you know, people like Mark Dever and Nine Marks and all these people, you know, which for them, they serve their space. They ain't writing to us. They ain't doing work for us. You know, no matter how much they try and convince themselves that they are, you know, at the end of the day, that's their platform, nor their practice is really built with us in mind. We could not be around and their thing still work. White people could not be around and their thing crumbles. And so when you think about that, you think about buildings, the metaphor of a house that I think Isabel Wilkerson and Cass brilliantly, oh my goodness, when she started talking about the house and the American house.
Yours was the second book I read this week that quoted that exact same passage from Cass.
Oh, for real? Yeah, that joint was powerful.
Yeah.
That joint was powerful. And I think about the late Professor Derek Bell's Black sci-fi piece, speculative fiction piece, The Space Traders, where he tells the story of like this trade from aliens, this trade of Black people, trading Black people and white Americans traded us, you know, or whatnot, because in some sense, we were integral, you know, as property and labor and capital, you know, but we were not integral and critical as people. And so I think, you know, the space, you know, that I was in was just a space that was not built for us. You know, it was a house that invited us in and we were long-term resident, but it was not a house that we would inherit once those who built it passed on.
But you know, when you said as much as they think that these theological writers, they think they're writing for you. And I'm going to push back a little bit. And here's what I'm going to say. I don't think they have you in mind when they're writing. I don't think they have me in mind when they're writing, to be truthful. I think what they think, and it's kind of, maybe it was Daniel Hill who first kind of introduced this idea to me, but I've taken it and use it, you know, when I think about this, it's this theology with a capital T, right? They think what they're writing is theology with a capital T. So they don't have your face in mind, and they don't have my face in mind when they're writing it. Yeah. They think that they're writing the theology.
Oh, without question. Yeah,
so
without
you
question.
Can have theology and that's great, but you know what it's called? Black theology. And I can have theology and that's great. And that's called Latina theology or feminist theology or fill in the blank theology. And someone else can have theology and that's great. And it's called post-colonial, or they can have theology and that's great, but it's called womanist, or they can have theology and that's great. And it's Asian American theology or whatever. You know, we can have global South theology. We can have whatever you want. And maybe they would name it. Maybe they wouldn't. Maybe they would call it theology, truthfully. And maybe they wouldn't. But I don't think these guys are writing with your face in mind or my face in mind.
Oh, without question.
I think they're writing because they think what they're writing is the theology. So you are going to be studying theology, then you are going to be conforming to whatever ideas they're writing about.
Oh, 100%.
Because that's 100%. Theology, right?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, so 100%.
It makes complete sense that you would teach a Piper book because that's theology.
Oh, without question. We're led to, we're discipled and socialized to believe that. Yeah.
Absolutely.
100%. Right? Yeah, 100%.
Right. And so it's great that you kind of, in quotes, that you happen to be Black and you're teaching this small group, you know, because you're teaching theology with a capital T. So if you're coming in to this, you know, and it's not, and I think we'd say the frustrating parts, it's like not recognized as even a space, like you introduced us to at the very beginning, right? It's not recognized as being a white social space. It just is.
It just is. It's normal.
This is church.
Yeah. You
know? Well, that's no, why, it's a white that, church. That's well, why, no, it's just
yeah,
church.
Yeah, 100. That's why I think, you know, that's why I think, you know, and that's why personally why I did this, especially when I'm talking about in those areas where I'm thinking in particular chapters that were more theological than not. That's why I wove like cultural studies into my book, because just as much as this is a memoir, like I wanted to write something theologically beautiful. Like I wanted to write something that did theology, like that's my training. My training is Zen theology. That's what I do. And so I wanted that to be woven. I felt like that was necessary. So I needed cultural studies in that. I needed, you know, critical theories in that and things like that. I needed to work in, you know, M. Sean Copeland and her beautiful ways of doing theology or whatnot and things like that. I needed that because for too long, we have believed that white theology is normative and like you said, and other theologies are contextual. And the reason why that's so bad, like the reason why that's such a terrible, terrible reality and belief is that it perpetuates the racist lie that white Christianity is the center of the faith and is the standard for everybody else's religious legitimacy.
While we're here, and we can cut this if it's too much of a spoiler, but I don't even know what I did, slap the table or something when I read this.
Oh, was it the
white Christians?
Joint?
Yes! Dang it, Dante, are you kidding me? How did you even know? No! Like,
no, you can read it though. Go ahead and read it.
Well, I don't have it pulled up right now. I'm reading my notes. And I said, this is what my notes say. So you can fill in the blanks. And my notes say it's on the Backroads chapter, Finding Home. And I just wrote, Aslan, but not Black Jesus. Hello. With a question mark. Hello, Dante. Hello.
Yeah, that's real. And for me, you know, that's why I wanted to be, as a writer, I felt like that's where I felt like I shined the most as a writer, is that like I was thinking as a theologian and a theorist, mm-hmm. but I was writing as an essayist. And so that section is all about decolonizing theology, but it's also about decolonizing epistemologies.
Right.
And so, but the way I wrote it, and this is kind of, I'm very proud of that, is I wove it into narrative. And I think that's where, you know, as a writer, that's what I'm most proud of in those areas, is where I think my ability as a writer shined through in those areas, which I was most proud of, is that like I was able to take theory, you know, and theology and weave it into testimony.
I can't find it. I was going to read it, but I can't find it as quickly as, cause that's the kicker. When I get these PDFs, I'm like, no, cause I'm a dog ear, you know, right in the margins anyway. But yes, this was rich. This was rich, the essence, right? And I'm going to spoil it if we can't find it, but the essence is that it is more possible for white Christians to envision Jesus as a lion than it is for them to envision Jesus as black.
Oh, yeah. And that's it. And that's not, and the thing is though,
come on,
that's not just Dante. A white Christian problem.
That's true.
It finds its heart in history in white Christianity.
Yes, yes, yes.
But that's my problem. That was my problem as a black Christian as well.
Come on. Yep, yep.
That was my problem. I believe that. Right. For so long, I believed that, and I acted on that belief, and my faith practice embodied that belief.
Yes, yes.
And so that's the thing, is like, you know, one of the things is like, I hope when people read my text, is like, you know, yeah, that's, we ain't the heroes, bro. This ain't just a like white people are terrible texts. Like, this ain't just like, this is a text that should. I mean, it made me think about it. I know as a writer, it at least made me think about a lot of stuff. You know? Right. I was doing a lot of soul searching and had to go through therapy while I'm writing, you know, and thinking and like that. But, you know, yeah, but it's not like, yo, like, yay, like white folk are terrible, you know? Hey, I mean, if that's your thing, cool. But like, it's also like, yeah, like that's what I had become.
Yes.
You know, and that's what I had believed for so long. Yes. And that's just a part of the story, and it is a part of the story that I must be honest about, and the ways in which that journey, both going through that space and leaving and getting distance from that space, opened up a certain type of clarity, not only about the space and its limitations, but also the type of person that it made me. And I think that's something, you know, that I hope people get from the journey, is to do an introspective work, you know, like when I read Kiese Layman's Heavy, you know, that book straight up changed the way I wrote. I mean, it just changed the way I wrote my book. Like when I read Heavy, there were sections in Heavy that I had to put down, like I had to stop reading. Mm-hmm. Because I had to think about what he wrote, because it was like, it made me think so much about myself. And even Jasmine Ward's, we were talking before we got began, like Jasmine Ward's memoir, Men We Reaped, and Sarah Broom's memoir, The Yellow House, and Darnell Moore's joint, No Ashes in the Fire. These books were memoirs that I was reading you know, and even Elizabeth Alexander's The Light of the World, as I was writing my book. And I'm like, I can't just write in a way that's just like, that's like a book that's simply about like correcting people and like, and I'm I gotta watch my mouth sometimes, but you know, like just,
you don't have to watch saying, it too much here, okay?
Okay, cool. Like simply throwing up middle fingers to white people, you know. I mean, there are sections in there where like I creatively and literarily through writing was essentially saying like, yeah, I ain't doing this, like middle fingers to what y'all think and what y'all doing, you know, but that part of my book is like, you know, there's so many parts in this book that's like, you know, like we need to do some real introspection. And when Jesus, you know, talks about coming that we may have life and this thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy, then we need to do that introspective work in the ways to think about the ways in which our faith does not bring life, the ways in which our faith and practice steals the humanity of others, how it kills their hopes and dreams for themselves and for others, and how it destroys both their bodies and their brilliance that they bring to the table. And so I couldn't just write that way. I was like, that's what I became. And that's what, you know, white people need to think about that deeply. Yes. But we also need to think about that as well, because just as much as white people, you know, are beholden to white supremacist notions of Christian faith and practice and politics and ideas, we can be, and many times are, beholden just as much as they are.
Yeah. I love the way, I'm thinking about, a pastor, Daniel Hill, wrote a book called White Lies last year. And the basis of it is essentially that white supremacy tells a lie about the Imago Dei, right? But the main point of that is a lot of times we think about that in the context of white supremacy hurts people of color because it causes some white people to act out in ways that are racist. Okay, that's about that much of it, right? White supremacy is a lie that hurts all of humanity, white people and people of color, because it tells something that is a blatant lie. It's something that is not true about the makeup of who we are as people. It hurts people of color in obvious ways and in ways that are not as obvious. And it hurts white people too, because they believe something about their own humanity and the humanity of their neighbors that is not true. It's not 100. What God says, right? It's not 100. Scriptural. It's not true. It's not biblical. And it's not godly. And we all can, and probably all have, in different aspects at different times of our life, internalized white supremacy to a degree, right? 100. And that's part of what you're talking about.
100. And I think that's why, like, a book like this, I felt I had to write, is because I had to write it for me.
Yeah.
Like, it was firstly a book I had to write for me because I needed to process what I had become. And the only way that I could is to write something that was vulnerable enough and recognizable enough that I not only would be healed and whole by the time we got to breath, but other people would feel courageous enough,
yes,
to start their journey as well.
Yes.
And by the time we get to that end, I'm like, by the time we get to that end, I want people to be like, first, I want people to be in tears. Cause like, I felt like, you know, like I
after tried, they get done slapping the table or whoever's next to them. So don't read this alone.
I tried to close my book as best I could. Like Jasmine Ward, I swear, Jasmine Ward, nobody closes a book like Jasmine Ward, and every single book I finished by her, by the time I got to the last line, I'm in tears, because what she wrote was so beautifully written, so beautifully human, so beautifully like hopeful, so like beautifully and brutally honest and like not triumphal. Hmm. And like you develop such a relationship with her characters that you don't want it to end, that the only thing you can do is like sit still and like, oh my goodness, like what in the, how did she do that? And first, that's how I hope people kind of like finish my book. You know, I hope that people be like, how in the world did you do that? How can you possibly do that? You know, as a book writer. But also I want people to really be like, you know, that freedom that we long for can be a possibility. You know, I may not experience that freedom of like that political freedom. I may not experience that social cultural freedom, but there is a certain freedom and liberation that's tied up into being able to take back my story that was stolen from me and to write it the way I would have wanted it to be written. And I think for so many people, and particularly I'm writing to Black people, like Toni Morrison, I'm unashamedly, like, and I will not apologize for that, like, at all, you know, and certain people, you know, I think certain writers say they're writing to Black people, you know, but their text, you know, you start kind of critically examining it. I mean, you know, it's, you see ways in which like, I don't know about that. And maybe in my text, there may be areas where you just like, and so I'm not above that. And that's why, you know, I thank God that, you know, I can keep writing and keep, and that the critical, I want critical analysis of my text and to converse with people critically about it, because I want to get better as a writer, as a thinker, you know, as a person, as a Christian, you know. But, you know, once I completed my book, I felt good about, I felt like Morrison, you know, when she said, you know, I'm writing for Black people, and I'm not going to apologize about that. But she has a, Toni has a line, I think I included it in the book. I think I did. It might not be in there. But she has a line from a 1974 essay with the New York Times. It's just a beautiful essay. It's simply entitled Growing Up Black Again. And I think, you know, for me, once we get to the end, I'm like, it's like a sermon, a letter, a worship service, a experience, a world that people hopefully, you know, especially Black folk, can walk through and say, you know, I think I'm ready to grow up Black again, or I'm on my way to growing up Black again.
Dante, it's so good. I just... Yeah, I will say... It's an American epistle. And I'm not Black. Mm. But I told you this before we started recording. I also am not a member at the church at Ephesus.
Yeah.
But I sure am glad that letter got written.
Yeah, 100.
That I can 100. Read it. 100. And I feel similarly about this book, about the books that you will write, about the way that you communicate. I remember now, this may not have been the initial point where we connected, but last year when everybody was in their homes for what felt like eternity, and we were on our phones and social media, and you talked about triumphalism.
Oh yeah. I remember that. I think.
And I did my best to listen, right? Because this, you're essentially saying, look, we're going to see what we're seeing right here, but this is not the time to act in this way. Like, this is some sort of triumphant moment. So listen. And I think the way that you close the book, there's hope for sure. But it recognizes that this is not a this triumphalist. Yeah. Is that a word? Kind of.
Yeah.
Kinda,
nah.
Right. There's hope.
Yeah. 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 That's real. And for me, you know, the book ends where it started. And that's the crazy part about it. It's like, you know, it ended like where it started, you know. That's where the hope is. The hope is in the living. That's where it lies at. The hope is in being able to get to that last page and say everything stylistically as a writer, you know. You know, as a craft, like I was very particular about the way I wove these chapters and craft this book. Like it I worked very, very hard on trying to read really, really good books and see how they're approaching their book and writing and try and imitate them in the best way possible, you know? So I want people, when they read my book, they're going to feel other people. Like they're going to feel Deesha Filiaw. They're going to feel James Cone. They're going to feel Toni Morrison. They're going to feel Honoré Fanon, Jeffers. They're going to feel Elizabeth Alexander. They're going to feel Katie Cannon. They're going to feel Kiese and Jason Reynolds and Imani Perry and Eddie Glaude and Cornel West. Like they're going to feel all these people. Like you're going to feel all these readers and writers and just, I mean, all these writers, you're going to feel their work. People from back then, like Tony K. Bambara and Baldwin and Nella, and you talked about passing earlier, Nella Larson's passing, you know, and things like that. People going to feel that. Like, I want them to feel that. And I wanted to imitate that, you know, and I wanted to also show, like, that's where the hope lies in what I have picked up along the way on my journey.
Yeah.
You know, that's where it lies, at least for me. Some people, you know, I'm not as theological about the kind of concept of hope anymore in some sense, you know, because I don't know if that does us, you know, any good per se. I want to be the type of person, you know, like those persons in Luke chapter 24 that had an experience, took whatever happened in that experience and took it to other people, even though that presence is not here anymore. That's something to think about theologically, but you know, that's for another day.
I love it. Now I'm going to be sitting with that one this afternoon in the carpool line. What are you doing? I'm distracted. Sorry. I'm thinking about Luke 24. Dante, what did I not ask? Where did I not take us? Where do you want?
That's cool.
Where do you want to leave us?
I always, like, if I'm honest, like, I don't think people ask me about writing enough, you know, about like the craft and skill. Like, it's not to say like I think I'm that writer, no, but like I just think like I want to talk about writing, you know, because I'd be wanting to talk about other people and what they do in their books. And like there's nothing funner for me than to talk about writing. Like I'm rereading Deesha Filiaw's book, The Secret Lives of Church Ladies, for the third time. And what Deesha was able to accomplish in this book is absolutely phenomenal. Like the way she crafted these stories and these narratives, doing a close reading of this text and the imagery, the world, the character, the tone, the feeling, the honesty, the love, the horror, the terror, the ugliness that she wrote with was just like, it's what I want to become. And so where I would leave people, you know, I would leave them in some senses to not read books, but try and do close reading of them. You know, I don't just read to complete books. Like, don't just read to, you know, collect books. Yes. collect books that you probably ain't going to read till 5-10 years later. That's okay. Like, there's always room for more books.
Amen.
But when you do open up a book, don't just read it to get through it, but like sit with the author. They put as they authors are deserving of readers who would not just simply read their text as if like it was not meant to be an experience. Mm-hmm. So like those memoirs that I quoted, the books that I quoted, get those. Like, them are some really good books. Them books are way better than mine. Like astronomically better than my book. Those writers are just, they are like my inspirations that I want to be like. You know, read their books because they have so much to say to us as Christians, and what we want to become and the type of people I think God wants us to be. So yeah, that's kind of where I lead us.
Well, it's phenomenal. We'll mention the title again. This is Shouting in the Fire, an American Epistle by Dante Stewart. It comes out, give us the release date, because this will come out just
October 12th.
October 12th.
Yeah, October 12th.
Pre-order right now anywhere, right?
Oh, yeah. You can pre-order, join the launch team, and everything, like pre-order and everything. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm telling you, it's phenomenal. The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.